This is WBEZ, National Public Radio, Chicago.
The views expressed on the following program are those of the participants and do not necessarily represent the views of WBEZ management.
Last Monday's shooting of President Reagan sent shockwaves throughout America, and Alexander Haig's conduct at the height of the drama has resulted in severe criticism. Tonight on Inside Politics, a discussion of this past week's historic events in Washington. And good evening, everyone. I'm your host, Bruce Dumont. I thank you very much for joining us this Thursday night on this expanded edition of Inside Politics. This evening, we will be here for 90 minutes right up until 8:30 so that we can fully discuss the major story of this past week, the shooting last Monday of President Reagan in Washington and the controversy surrounding the comments of Secretary of State Alexander Haig during the height of the drama. And with us in the studio to share their thoughts on this most historic week, we have F. Richard Ciccone, political editor of the Chicago Tribune, co-author of a delightful book on Chicago's power elite called Who Runs Chicago, and a frequent visitor to this program. Thomas Roser is also here, vice president of government relations of a major Chicago-based corporation, president of the City Club of Chicago, and a regular member of the Inside Politics panel. Ed Rooney also joins us, former reporter for the Chicago Daily News, assistant professor of journalism at Loyola University, and a moderator of a media politics seminar at St. Xavier College. Larry Horst is also here, chairman of his own governmental relations consulting firm, veteran campaign strategist, making his first appearance on our program. He is a lifelong political animal and currently a consultant to the National Tax Limitation Committee, which is responsible for setting up grassroots support for President Reagan's economic package here in the Middle West. Our telephone number is 236-1531, should you wish to offer your comments on this past week's tragic events in Washington, or if you would like to question our guests or challenge what they have to say, do give us a call. 236-1531 is our telephone number. We'll turn to calls shortly, and again, a reminder, we will be with you until 8:30 this evening, so we can take as many calls as possible. Gentlemen, with the President's physical recovery apparently moving along very nicely and all going well physically in Washington for the president, let us turn our attention to the political ramifications of the president's shooting. How do each of you feel that this will affect Mr. Reagan? Dick Ciccone?
Well, I think it's certainly going to enhance his popularity. I'm not so sure that it is going to make smooth sailing for his economic program in the Congress. I think the budget cut proposals that are already moving rapidly through the Senate probably will gather impetus from this week's events, and I suspect that he will get a good deal more out of the Senate in terms of budget cutting than he may have gotten prior to the shooting. On the other hand, I think the tax bill proposals in the House are moving very slowly, and it may not be until certainly late spring, early summer, before there's any kind of concrete proposal up there. At that point, it well could be that any admirations or sympathies that have been engendered in the past week will have dissolved to the point that those Democrats who cannot abide by the Reagan tax cut package will be more willing than they would be this week to reject them. However, if in fact the Senate does a good job of budget cutting, then the House Democrats will probably be more willing to go along with tax cuts.
Larry, as someone who is involved in getting grassroots support for the Reagan package, do you think that the shooting of the president is going to help you politically?
Well, I think it's going to be a plus, and obviously an unanticipated plus. But I think he is going to have heightened popularity. He's going to be able to talk to the people of the country in a little different vein than he had, a bit of a hero now, besides being a elected president. And I think that's going to translate into greater pressure on Congress. The effort to get grassroots support, I think, is going to go along much quicker and with more support than we might have been able to engender had the president not had this misfortune. So I think that popularity is going to translate into something meaningful in Congress and pressure on Congress.
Ed Rooney, what's your thought on the political ramifications of the shooting?
Political ramifications, I would say that I would agree with Dick that he's certainly going to enhance Reagan's popularity for the remainder of the term, and if he wishes to seek re-election, certainly wouldn't hurt him. I would be concerned about the opportunities that Dick Saccone and other reporters will have in getting news out of the president as he travels now, if he travels around the country in the remainder of the year. The Secret Service obviously is going to be much more difficult. They've always been difficult for reporters again. It'll be much more difficult now because of this shooting.
Tom Roser, what's your thoughts on the political horizon for the president as a result of the shooting?
I think that if you can imagine John Kennedy surviving an assassination in Dallas with the communication skills that Kennedy had, and translate that to a man who was uniquely qualified also to render communications about like Kennedy and about like Roosevelt, you have really a chemical reaction now that I don't think any of us can gauge. I think the Congress, as Larry has said, the Congress really is dependent far more than ever before, less on parties and far more on that grassroots swing. And although Dan Rostenkowski has laid down the battleground and said, okay, now there's not going to be a Kemp Roth, I doubt that. I don't think that's the final thing we heard from Danny. So I would say that the old actor's campaign is going to really step up now. Not that he consciously will be turning up the game, but I think that any politician who has survived this kind of a thing can use these human qualities very well, and Reagan is a master at it.
Well, the initial poll that was released last night by ABC Washington Post said there was an increase, I think, of 11% because of the shooting. I can't figure out why people automatically like a president just after he has been shot. Is there an 11% sympathy percentage in the polls?
I think that, and this is again, as Larry has said, a very ironic and almost grisly way to describe it. The way that the man has reacted to the assassination attempt, almost like Duke Wayne walking in the emergency room, as somebody said, almost biting on the bullet and saying, okay, handle this thing. It is a scenario that I think is brilliant so far as politics is concerned. He's a great survivor. And Ed, I imagine you have seen this thing as many others, maybe even been around, and I'm sure you were during the Kennedy days. Yep. You can imagine John Kennedy having survived this kind of a thing. You've got a commodity here.
Dick Saccone?
Tom, I talked to a congressman in Washington yesterday, and at the risk of sounding macabre, his comment was, well, they didn't shoot Kemp Roth. There's not going to be any sympathy for Kemp Roth because of the shooting of Ronald Reagan. And I still think that if that tax bill gets slowed down into the summer, that, in fact, the president may not get what he wants out of Congress on that score. His personal popularity, I think the ABC poll and every other poll, certainly is going to rise.
But, Dick, what happens then when a president who has these communication skills then goes to the people and says, without even bringing up this kind of a thing, how much persuasiveness does a guy have now that he has survived all this? That's the thing I don't know.
And the one question I have for all of you is, what effect will this have on local Republicans such as Thompson, who's having all sorts of problems this afternoon with RTA legislation in the General Assembly? What, if anything, will this do to other Republicans around the country that Reagan might be out seeking to help later this year?
I don't know whether an assassination attempt rubs off on anybody. That I doubt.
Well, I think local Republicans, not only in Illinois but elsewhere, have already been looking toward 1982 with the kinds of rather harsh economic programs that Reagan has suggested, at least harsh in some sectors, the lower economic groups, the minority groups, and have been frightened that perhaps if Reagan bites the bullet, a bad pun at this time, in terms of his first 2 years, doing all the hard things, and then escalating his personal popularity by dealing with easier issues in the second 2 years, which is a very common presidential practice, then a lot of local Republicans, from the governor on down in every state, are going to be running in 82 at a time when, last Monday's occurrence accepted, the president might have been at a lower ebb. Now, given the events of last Monday, that may not come to pass. So I would think, as of today, you would say a Jim Thompson or everyone else is ahead.
One of Ronald Reagan's strongest suits has always been his willing to go out and mix with the people. Do you think the events of last Monday are going to keep him from going out and mixing with the folks, Larry?
No, I think the president's going to go out and mix. Obviously, the Secret Service is going to be even more watchful. They're going to have to put him under tighter scrutiny. But I still think you're going to see him go out. You may not see the transition openness, like coming from the hotel door where there might be 100 people who casually were there at the moment, realized that the president was going to come out momentarily and gathered on the scene. But I still think you're going to see a president going into situations where there will be crowds, and that he'll accommodate those crowds with his presence and pressing the flesh.
That's the lifeblood, poor pun, of a politician.
Yeah.
It was a physical campaigning. If Thompson said this last night, that he and Reagan were considered as physical campaigners, people would get out and shake hands in the crowd.
If you could have created a scenario of how Ronald Reagan would have acted had he got shot, you would have said he probably would have acted like he did. There was a macho kidding about him, and I think we can predict how he'll act in the aftermath.
Senator Presser of South Dakota said today that his recommendations would be for the president to have a lot of television appearances and stay away from the people, and I don't think this president or any elected official who sweats and who likes that feel of the crowd, that kind of communication thing is going to happen.
Gentlemen, we're going to turn to the telephone calls right now. 236-1531 is our telephone number. If you'd like to join our discussion and give your thoughts on what happened this past week, do give us a call. 236-1531. Good evening, Steve. You're on the air.
Well, good evening. I have two comments. One's on Haig and one's on the president himself.
Okay.
But I think the president has fostered through his movies and through his own gun control, no, I don't want it thing, and he's fostered as much of the attitude that got him shot. So I'm very sorry for him personally, but it's just part of the whole thing.
Okay, let's talk about that. That was basically the focus of Gary Will's column today. But
what will Reagan's position now be on handgun controls?
So does anybody at this table believe it's going to change at all?
I would think it'll change.
I'm sorry. I would think that he shouldn't change his position strictly from a political standpoint, because now that he has received the gunshot wound, now it's a very desirable thing to have gun control. So I would imagine he'd continue it, his opposition to gun controls.
Okay, what's your comment on Al Haig?
Well, everybody's given him a lot of flack, but I think that really what he said was that he blew the Constitution thing. He just forgot a few people in line. But he said he's in control. He didn't say charge. He said he's in control. Somebody's got a hand on the helm. And I don't like him at all, but I think that he did the right thing.
That hand was sort of quavery, though, as I recalled. At least the voice was very tremulous. Wasn't the hand a little shaky there at the end?
He was very shaky.
He has to satisfy Ed Meese and Jim Baker, who he's been having some problems before the shooting and apparently some problems since then. That's the biggest obstacle that he has right at the moment is Meese and Baker.
All right, now since he went before the cameras last Monday, there have been numerous press reports that Meese and James Baker were very upset with Al Haig for doing it, as well as Mr. Weinberger. Defense Secretary Weinberger was upset. Although last night on ABC's Nightline, Baker and Meese were both there, and they categorically denied all those reports and said that there was absolutely nothing to them.
How could they say otherwise?
That was the point I was going to make. Is anybody was surprised by what they said last night?
Here's an expert in denial.
Dick Ciccone?
No, of course, that's precisely what they would say, and I think Al Haig is definitely going to be downgraded in importance in the White House, and I think he will not be fired. That's not Reagan style. I think you'll see a resignation sometime within the next 2 years. But I think the flip side is a little more important in terms of politics and looking down the road. Al Haig wants to be president of the United States, a powerful Secretary of State, very influential. Would have postured himself very, very prominently for perhaps 84, should Reagan not decide to seek another term, or perhaps 88. He's still a young enough man. His major obstacle at the moment, and politics changes so rapidly, I don't want to get too far into the future, but the major obstacle is George Bush, who by virtue of Haig's difficulties with handling crisis situations is now benefiting more than ever. And if anyone has come out of this looking very well, especially in the long road, it's George Bush.
Don't you think that since Dick Ciccone has written a series of columns about really good Jane, bad Jane. If you take Meese and Baker, after all the television sets are snapped off, the good guys say, oh, yeah, the Secretary of State's done a great job. The bad guys, or at least the realistic guys, will say, well, now that the set is off, let's try to figure out how we can get rid of this guy, because he has really caused a great deal of emotional concern about the welfare of the country.
You also have to remember that Reagan also early on indicated that he doesn't want fighting in public. He has indicated to the cabinet members that he does not want them to use the media as a vehicle to get at each other, but that doesn't mean they're not going to fight. I think Baker and Meese are following that lead from the president. They're not going to fight in public, but they are going to fight privately.
Steve, you've got the last word. Go ahead.
Well, I'm just glad that he's going to be okay, and I hope that other guy that got it in the head's going to...
Okay, James Brady, we all hope that. Thank you very much. 236-1531 is the telephone number. Good evening, Bob. You're next.
Yes. First of all, I'd like to let you say, just a short comment, a couple comments. Surviving death, I think, has a tendency to change anyone, you know, some. But if we recall, it didn't change Martin Luther King much, you know. I mean, he came on stronger after the attempt, after he escaped that scissors in his chest, much stronger, maybe even a little too strong.
Mm-hmm.
Then after that, but I think he's going to realize, the way I see it, that more and more citizens have a tiger growing inside them, you know, fathered by the vibes of the society, you know, the fears and the murders and the assaults brought on by socioeconomic imbalance, you know, the thick paranoia inside the haves brought on by the have-nots. You know what I'm saying? The blend of the society.
Mm-hmm.
The whole overall climate of the society makes me see a whole lot of would-be assassins or would-be people who are not able to control this tiger.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I thank you very much for your comment. Let us move on. Good evening, Rudy. You're next.
Hi. Bruce?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm here helping my wife with the dishes, and I'm listening to your very fascinating show.
Thank you.
And the thing that's come up to me is this. I'm listening to all these negative comments on Haig, and I'm reading about how bad a guy he is. Maybe he is, maybe he isn't. But this is my question. As I understand it, Deaver, Baker, and Meese were all at the hospital attending to the president, right? Or attempting to be at his side, right?
Deaver was there immediately. Baker and Meese came over as soon as they heard that the president had been shot. Yes.
Okay, so here are the American people. Listening, understandably, to a lot of radio. I happen to be listening to the radio myself.
Mm-hmm.
We're listening to the radio to conflicting stories, you know. The president hasn't been hit, the president has been hit. Then you begin to wonder. I'm just Joe Ordinary Citizen here. You begin to wonder, well, what's going on back at the nerve center of the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
at the White House, you know, where really the decisions are made, where the black boxes or whatever it is. Maybe Haig figured, hey, I should step in here and reassure the American people. Or who else was there to do it in the absence of the president's right-hand lieutenants being at his side at the hospital?
Well, after it was all over, later that, or actually the very next day, a State Department spokesman said that one of the reasons why Al Haig went on television was not only to reassure the American people, which obviously many American people were not reassured by the nature in which the statements were made, but he said that because of some crucial intelligence information which they had received earlier in the day, the real reason he went on was to assure our allies and our adversaries that things were under control, because there was some intelligence information that perhaps there might have been a move on the Polish border that morning. So that was the justification he used. Larry Horst has an additional comment.
Well, sure. I think I would say that, you know, his performance was inept. However, you know, whatever led up to that performance,
agree.
It was an inept performance.
I can't even caught it on the radio. He was very nervous.
He was too shaky. He didn't seem to be in control of himself. And also his constitutional faux pas and other things. I think it was an inept performance.
Let me just interject for a moment. I agree with what you say, but I think everyone at this table would also say that, can anyone say that they would have handled it better, or anyone else would have handled the situation better? To go on national television with the pressures that he was under, and to be Mr. Cool. Now, granted, I think the person that everyone, at least that I have been hearing in the last couple of days, admiring, is the coolness with which Dr. O'Leary at the hospital has conducted himself.
Yes.
However, when you compare the pressures that were on Dr. O'Leary with the pressures that were on Al Haig, I think we're talking about apples and oranges. So
sure.
I think perhaps we shouldn't overstate the fact that Al Haig was a little quivery, because I think we would all be quivery.
I'm not just talking about that. I'm talking about his whole demeanor and the use of the term, I am in control. And while he thought that was reassuring, you juxtapose that to the constitutional faux pas, and it didn't come out too reassuring. The danger to Haig is what happened before he went on. If, for example, two quick scenarios, they were meeting there and gathering as they should and decided, okay, someone has to go out and reassure him, and Secretary of State, you're here, why don't you go do it? Then he may be okay. On the other hand, if he came in there, and we don't know, but if he came in there in a sort of bullish way and say, hey, I'm in charge now and I'm going to do this, and by the way, I'm going to go out and reassure the country, then the knives are going to be out for him in the administration.
Well, supposedly he had left a cabinet meeting to run up and no one knew where he had went.
Then he's in trouble.
Have you heard any more about that meeting?
No, there has not been any definite explanation of how and why Haig got in front of that camera. But I agree completely with Larry, and my suspicion is that neither Jim Baker nor Ed Meese, who in fact were running government, told Al Haig to go out and do that.
And I suspect that's right.
Told himself.
That's right.
It should be said for Dr. O'Leary that, number one, he did not operate on the president, and he obviously was told by his colleagues at the hospital that somebody has to go out there and answer the questions. And he had maybe a half hour's or an hour's warning before he faced the press to prepare himself, but he did a magnificent job.
He is also, we should mention, he is also a surgeon who I'm sure is used to operating under pressure. We're using a lot of questionable puns tonight. But
and a surgeon, I suppose. At least when you're facing the news media, a surgeon has it up on the news media. After all,
sure.
Were I a surgeon, I'd say the president is okay. Now, I'm telling you that, and you, Ed Rooney, are not going to say, well, he isn't, because I know better than you. Haig, in justification to him, didn't have that expertise, and he had to say the country is good, and a lot of people were wondering about the country. The only thing that bothered me is about Haig is not that he showed up there, but that I thought technically, and I'd be under the rug, so let's not have any worry about that, or anybody else as Bruce says, how would you behave? I'd behave terribly. I'm not the Secretary of State, and the key part of a Secretary of State is negotiation and the presentment, I suppose, of good vibes for the country. I think Al Haig flunked out as far as a presentment, really, of a sound, orderly procedure. I think he flunked.
Rudy, go ahead, Dick. I'm sorry.
Well, we've made probably all of us in our minds at one point or another this week a lot of correlations to the John Kennedy shooting in Dallas 18 years ago. But you know, one thing we haven't touched on from your question is George Bush. He was still the Vice President of the United States. He was alive and well, and all the communication in the world could be put at his given to him immediately. And when Kennedy was slain, Lyndon Johnson was no closer to the White House than George Bush was. They were both in the same place, as a matter of fact, in Texas. Just because Lyndon Johnson happened to be accompanying John Kennedy, he was sworn in on the airplane, returned to Washington, to the very same Andrews Air Force Base where George Bush flew in the other night. But we saw no one at that time in Washington saying, we're watching the White House until somebody gets here. And that's precisely what Al Haig tried to do the other day.
George Will, last Monday night on Nightline, made a comment that at the time of the crisis, the president was acting presidential. He walked into the hospital. He was making jokes. By his every move, he was reassuring the American people that all was well. The vice president had been notified. He was already making his way back to Washington. The only person that put a snag in the whole ointment that day that created any doubt at all was Al Haig.
And I think that Dick Ciccone here is generous when he gives Haig 2 years, within 2 years, to resign. Mm-hmm. I would think, Dick, that more likely it would be by Christmas.
The thing that bothered me about Haig and the thing that happened before the assassination attempt, Haig has been virtually stripped, I think, of command. It's almost like you can take a guy in the old Civil War films where they break the sword over their knee and throw it out, pull off all the things and everything else, and you walk out as a private citizen. What the administration has said is that Al Haig is in charge of foreign policy until there is a crisis. and then it's going to be George Bush. Now, I think that's a pretty heavy thing to try to do. If my boss were to say, well, Roser is in charge of the day-to-day conduct, except when in government relations policy there's a crisis somebody else is, I don't know what the heck I can use then to deal with the other constituencies. I don't know what Al Haig is going to do.
Okay, Rudy, you got a comment?
Yeah, I got a final comment.
Okay.
I agree that Haig handled it ineptly. I agree with the gentleman that Haig is probably a frighteningly ambitious man, and he scares us all. Yet I think he's trying to do a good job. But I'd like to refer to Reagan's comment when he entered the hospital. He saw Meese and Baker there. He says, "Who's watching the stork?" I wonder if there wasn't even a mild and a good-humored reprimand there. Let me ask you this. Isn't it feasible that one of them might have said, "Hey, I'm going to stay back here at the White House," if only to watch that guy Haig? I mean, wouldn't that have been a prudent thing to do?
That's an interesting comment. Everybody's nodding, yeah, Larry.
Well, everyone's hanging Haig, and perhaps he deserves it. But why don't you take him on a very mature level too?
It's a good point. He was the senior cabinet guy, and they did leave him in charge of the store, Larry.
And maybe that was a mistake to leave him in charge of the store. But I think we might be in a danger here of thinking that everything needs the immediate attention of the president. Reagan is a delegator of authority. For very short periods of time, things can go on in the government. The vice president can be put in charge of a crisis situation very, very quickly. And I think that in that context, the country did not need the reassurance of Alexander Haig at that time. Sometimes you doth protest 2 months. You keep reassuring. They reassured me so much that I thought Reagan was dying by the time I was reassured.
Yeah,
okay, Rudy, thank you very much for your comment.
Bye-bye.
Okay, 236-1531 is the telephone number. We'll get back to calls in just a moment. One other point that I think we should follow up on is you mentioned that Alexander Haig was constitutionally incorrect when he said that constitutionally it was the president, the vice president, and the secretary of state. Later that night, the White House, through Larry Speaks, released information that actually in the chain of command, it was Caspar Weinberger who was third in line. Constitutionally, as far as the line of succession, it was the president, the vice president, the speaker of the House, the president pro tem of the Senate, Strom Thurmond, and then the secretary of state. That's line of succession. That's constitutional 25th Amendment stuff. However, the chain of command had been determined in a memo dictated by or an order by President Reagan shortly after he was elected, which said that in case of military crisis, it was the president, the vice president, and the secretary of defense. Is it possible that Al Haig learned about that when he heard it from Larry Speaks? Is it possible that he didn't know that he was in charge?
I suspect that's the case, and I was watching ABC News last night at 11 o'clock, and after the serenade of, gee, Al Haig on the part of Baker and Meese, Al Haig has just done a great job and everything else, saying that they didn't ask him to do it, he did a great job. Very clear to me again that you have Al Haig out of the decision-making thing in terms of crisis. The president wrote that letter, I think, and Haig wasn't included. Whether Haig knew it or not, I don't know. But I just think there's another case where Haig is offshore.
Well, you know, the perfect parable there is last year when Jimmy Carter got himself into a lot of trouble by getting involved in defense policy and state policy and not telling his Secretary of State, Ed Muskie, about it. So I think I would agree completely. That's the first sign that you're in trouble in the cabinet. They don't tell everybody everything, and apparently Haig may have not been informed of this decision, perhaps just to avoid his obstinacy about it.
In case you've just joined us, I'm Bruce Dumont. This is Inside Politics. We're coming to you from WBEZ Radio in Chicago, and joining us this evening to talk about this past week's historic events in Washington, we have F. Richard Ciccone, who you just heard speak. He is the political editor of the Chicago Tribune and co-author of a great book called Chicago's Power Elite. It's been out for a little over a year now. It's a good book called Who Runs Chicago? He is a frequent visitor to this program, as is Thomas Roser, a vice president of government relations for a major Chicago-based corporation, president of the City Club of Chicago. Larry Horst also joins us. This is his maiden voyage on Inside Politics. He is chairman of his own government relations consulting firm, a veteran campaign strategist, former Washington lobbyist, a lifelong political animal, and currently he is consultant to the National Tax Limitation Committee, which is responsible for setting up grassroots support for President Reagan's economic program here in the Midwest. Ed Rooney also, this is his maiden voyage. He is a former reporter for the Chicago Daily News, assistant professor of journalism at Loyola University, and moderator of a media politics seminar at St. Xavier College. Our telephone number, 236-1531. We would be interested in your comments on the events of this past week, whether you want to talk about the assassination, the security, the Secret Service security, or if you would like to comment on Secretary of State Alexander Haig. 236-1531. It's exactly 7:30. Good evening, Liz. You're on the air.
Good evening, Bruce. I just love this show tonight, and now I know why Henry looked so tense and so morose on Koppel's show Monday night. His boy blew it. He showed his true, you know, let's have a war colors, and Kissinger knows it. The crisis manager can't grace us. He just can't. I'd like to make a couple other comments. One is that on what happened on TV, I think Mr. Rather really is Chicken Little. His sky is falling constantly. He's lost his credibility with me completely.
In what way?
Well, for example, he had a doctor on. And Reagan has now been in the OR, 2 hours or so? And he was pressing, or it appeared, that he's pressing the doctor to say, this is an extraordinary time. And the doctor kept backing off. And one got the feeling that Rather wanted a crisis so badly, he was going to force the doctor to say it was a crisis. Which also is a part of the comment I'd like to make about the networks generally. I think they would be well advised to take note that the, quote, scoop mentality really hung out for all to see. I think they ought to learn pretty fast that we really care more about accuracy. We don't give a damn who said it first. I don't really think we do.
Let's let each of our participants comment on the TV or radio coverage or whatever coverage that they were listening to or viewing when they got the news. Let's go right around the horn. Larry?
Well, I thought, first of all, having the doctors on was shameless theater. You can't go to a doctor on that kind of basis and get any kind of diagnosis as a patient. And I really felt that was just shameless theater. They hadn't the vaguest idea what was going on. They were going on, obviously, the media reports, which throughout the day were showing themselves to be inaccurate. I'm a channel switcher, so I was watching them all. I gave Frank Reynolds the low marks. I thought he was borderline hysterical, and the oh my gosh and golly and everything else that went along with it.
He was quivering more than Al Haig.
I will say one thing, though. The source of the information on Jim Brady dying, Tom Roser told me he died because someone in his office had told me he died. I said I hadn't seen it on television yet. 5 minutes later, it was on television, so I fear that it emanated from your office. I don't know, Tom.
Tom, the thing that bothered me, knowing and loving Jim Brady, as all of us do as an Illinoisan, seeing Dan Rather, now he gets a report that Brady is dead from congressional sources, and he has a minute of silent prayer for the soul of Jim Brady on television, which is unusual. And then he's told that Jim Brady lives. Now, I, of course, am pulling for Jim Brady only. I'm pulling for him anyway, but especially to see the videotape, as Mark Twain says, that the rumor of my death has been greatly exaggerated, to see that he is the guy that had a minute of silent prayer for Jim Brady. I thought that was a little dramatic. Not that, because it was an undefined report. After all, Howard Baker's crowd said Jim Brady is dead, and immediately Rather goes to the silent prayer thing. I thought it was a little...
We should also mention, throw another name in. The report was initially reported by Jed Duvall of CBS Washington, and Dan Rather, who was anchoring at the time, then repeated what Jed Duvall said. This was not a report that was initially broken by Dan Rather.
That's right.
He did pause for a moment of silence.
From congressional sources, though, which bothered me. I mean,
he named it was Senator Baker's office.
Yeah. But I mean, Senator Baker's office isn't the final, I don't think, the final word on whether we live or die yet.
Right.
And I think especially, I thought it was a very quick decision.
That was an error on the part of Jed Duvall, who made the initial report.
Many of us have grown up under the advice of people like Bill Mooney, who used to work on Daily News, who was always saying, quote, count the bodies, end quote. Don't mean to be grisly here, but what Mooney was trying to say over the years was, check it, check it, check it. Television didn't have that luxury. They went on to, this was very untidy for television to try to cover minute to minute, hour to hour, Monday. Overall, they probably did a good job, but they made a lot of mistakes. We'll remember the mistakes more than we will remember the good reporting, such as Ted Koppel, some other people who did a good job.
One thing that happened, and I guess before we get to Dick, since Jim Brady was hit by bullets, it was that function then which left after Kennedy was assassinated. You did have a superb White House press thing which was feeding in, and maybe that's the reason why the networks weren't...
You didn't have any policeman or coroner or doctor saying that Jim Brady was dead. That's where the...
Right.
That's the failure.
Well, I thought, much like everyone, the Jim Brady report was a tragic error, both in journalism and also a very emotional one for all of his friends and the whole country. And I would have wished, I think I was looking at CBS at the time, that rather would have stressed repeatedly, without asking for a moment of prayer, that this is an unconfirmed rumor, that as Ed just said, the doctor, the hospital, the coroner, no one else has said this. It well could be a rumor on Capitol Hill, but we do have it. And secondly, you know, in terms of the print media compared to television, the visuals that they can produce when they have cameramen at the scene are unescapably dramatic, timely, and if they just would shut up, the words they add to their pictures tend to distort the good all they do. Throughout the day on all the channels, they had all the tape. And the sounds, the people screaming, the shock, the terror, was so real. And I think it was probably, and I shouldn't even guess, but I will say, one out of five times they let you have the sound. The other four times they ran the film silent so some very highly paid commentator could talk over it, right, and tell you what you were seeing.
I could not agree more. Thank you very much for bringing up that point, Liz. Is there anything else?
I want to make one comment on this. I really hope that the networks understand that they are their pictures are good, but they cannot fill that much time with language when they don't know what they're saying. Also, I would like to change the subject. I would like to hear your...
Let me just add one point, though. I mean, your criticism of the media, I think, is well taken. But I disagree to one extent. Imagine the criticism of television had they made the announcement and gone back to Love of Life a game show.
I agree with that. I agree with that, Bruce, but I'm sure there would be another device. I think we could talk...
Well, you must stay on. Once you make the commitment to stay on, you can't go back to the soap operas, and once you're on, when the story is breaking, you do run in and you do make stupid mistakes like was made when announcing that Jim Brady had died.
I think we should also add that new information was slow in coming. I mean, there you are on camera,
yeah,
and they weren't getting
happens.
They weren't
that's
getting
so
new information,
well,
so you had the rehashing.
Maybe the best decision then would be to break in on Love of Life every 3 minutes and say, the president... First, they said he was not here.
Can't do it because the competition, you can't get reporters or editors or news media managers to agree on even the precise time, let alone agreeing that they would all go back to their commercial shows for 20 minutes and then come back to them.
We should mention, though, that all three networks did do just that for, I believe, two, in some cases, and one network, and in three bulletin reports or special reports on other networks. They did do that sporadically at least two or three times before they made the commitment, which I think was roughly around 1:55, 2 o'clock, to go, you know, continuous.
Well, there's got to be a better way, is what I think.
Okay. Well, let me say this. If two stations had had bulletins interrupting every 10, 15 minutes, 5 minutes, or whatever, and one station, one network had gone on and stayed on, I, for one, would have been on the network that would have stayed on, waiting for the new development, frustrated like them that it wasn't coming, or the new report, or the latest. But I would have been there watching the one that stayed on and not the one that interrupted.
I have to give you that. I would have done that, too.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. On the subject of media, our telephone number is 236-1531. In case you've just joined us, we're joined this evening by Thomas Roser, Larry Horst, Ed Rooney, and Dick Ciccone of the Chicago Tribune. They're not all of the Chicago Tribune, just Dick Ciccone is with the Trib. Our telephone number is 236-1531. We'll get back to calls in just a moment. But on the subject of the media, it kind of leads into an area that we also were just recently discussing, and that is what Al Haig said and the controversial nature and the context with which he said it. Regular listeners to the program know that my regular job is producing the Lee Phillips Show over at Channel 2. So I had an opportunity just before the program this evening to go back and to watch the off-air videotape of exactly what happened last Monday. There also is, when you look at videotape, there is a time code, so you know exactly the time when certain things are said. Let me just run down a time scenario here. It isn't every single second of every single minute, but listen to the time frame, because I think some of it might be of interest. First of all, the first video of the shooting of President Reagan on CBS occurred at 1:47 last Monday. At 2:11 and 50 seconds, Lynn Nofsinger was quoted. He was not on camera. He was quoted by Jed Duval as saying that the president was hit. That was the first announcement that there was acknowledgement that the president was hit. Prior to that, of course, the word out of the White House was that the president was safe. At 2:38, Dave Gergen of the White House staff quoted James Baker, who was with the president at the hospital, and it was at that point that we first learned that President Reagan had walked in under his own steam. He also announced at that time, we're talking about Dave Gergen, that Vice President Bush had been alerted and that the president's condition was stable. Let's go several minutes ahead. At 3:11 and 40 seconds, Larry speaks, who at that time was the White House acting press secretary and the spokesman. At that time, he refused to confirm that the president was in surgery. There had been rumors that had been circulated, and the networks all had reported that they had heard rumors that the president was in surgery. However, Larry speaks at 3:11 and 40 seconds, neither would confirm nor deny those reports that were being circulated. And he said, that's all I can say at this time. He came back a few minutes later. They were going in and out of live coverage, as you can appreciate. If you saw it, you know what I'm talking about. At 3:11 and 35 seconds, Speaks again refused to confirm that the president was under surgery or in surgery. Just a few moments later, in fact, less than a minute later, now this was Larry Speaks, ends his press conference at the White House. They go back to Dan Rather. Dan Rather is on the air making commentary for approximately 15 seconds. Then Al Haig walks into the press room at the White House, and less than a minute after Larry speaks, refused to confirm that the president was in surgery. Al Haig, during his press conference, confirmed that the president was in surgery, although he did say that the president was stable. He was the one that broke the news that the president was undergoing surgery, and he was also the first person ever to suggest that the injury might be serious, because it was Al Haig who made the comment that the president had been shot through the left chest and it went into the left lung. So the question of the severity of the wound and the fact that the president was being operated on was not an official White House statement. It was made by the Secretary of State, Al Haig.
And when you say also he took a round, now I'm not a soldier, but I always thought when a fellow says he took a round, that means several bullets or a round of something. I didn't think it was one, but that bothered me.
I want to get additional response from our other guests, but we do have to pause. 236-1531, back in 60 seconds.
You can become a WBEZ member and receive our monthly program guide for 1 year. This guide contains detailed schedules of all WBEZ programs, including our jazz, folk and classical music. Why, it even has interviews and articles with all your favorite WBEZ personalities. To make your pledge and become a member, please call 641-4088. That phone number again is 641-4088. We'll send you all the information you need on where to send your check or money order. Please, become a member in the WBEZ family and help keep commercial-free radio going strong in Chicago. Thanks a lot. Now let's return to Inside Politics with Bruce Dumont.
If you wish to talk to Bruce and his guests, please call our talk line number at 236-1531. That's 236-1531.
Okay, we are back on the air. Larry Horst, you had a comment on the timetable that I had given with what Al Haig said.
Well, I was just going to comment that it had been a missed signal to the Allies, if that's what he had wanted to do, too, because it is not comforting to the other countries to think that they had been feeling that, you know, the president was not going into surgery, and now he was going into surgery, and there'd be a, you know, some period of time, and at that time, you know, God knows how long, that he was going to be under anesthesia.
Yeah, the other thing that it would seem to me that when Larry Speaks made his comment, that that's all he could say at that time, or at this time. He was obviously, and correct me if you think I'm wrong on this, he was obviously operating under instructions that he was given by Baker and by Meese.
Right. No question.
So the question of what Al Haig goes out and blows the cover that the president is in surgery and that it might be serious if it went into the lung, to me, I don't see how Al Haig could be making those statements based on anything that he had been told to say by Baker and Meese, that he was talking out of school at that moment. Do you agree with that, Dick?
I do, and I'd like to comment also on the failure of the White House to provide communications because the White House press secretary, Jim Brady, was in fact critically injured. As a matter of fact, they had one of the best pros in the business standing by there all day in Lynn Nofsinger. Mm-hmm. And Nofsinger did take over. I'm not so sure that he didn't take over right from the very start, and I'm not sure that he wasn't passing the signals to Larry Speaks at the White House in terms of what should be given out to the public and the press or what not should not be given. And as we saw later in the evening, Nofsinger was in complete control, and in fact, and I don't mean this to be critical in any way, I was just rather amazed at how even and almost at times jocular he was in what seemed to be a very critical situation.
Mm-hmm. We should also mention that the statements about that Al Haig made were made in context with all the other more controversial, highly reported things. Just to repeat those, he said that the vice president was returning to Washington at the time, that the cabinet was together in the White House and were meeting, that the Allies were informed that the president's condition was stable and that he is undergoing surgery, which is a direct quote from Al Haig at the time, that no military alert was necessary. He, at that point, he mentioned that crisis management was in effect, and that was when he made his comment that, you know, constitutionally speaking, gentlemen, I am in charge, or I am in control, pending, you know, that anything were to happen, that if the president were to pass control or pass duties on, that he would check with the vice president, and then he closed that rather short, about 2 minute and 25 second press conference with the announcement that the president had been shot in the left chest, in the left lung, and that surgery was underway to remove the round, as Tom Roser just alluded to. Okay, let us, Larry, you had a comment that we're going to pause.
I think we all tend to agree that Haig's statement was maladroit, but I think there was a series of things that were unsettling. A bit of deja vu for those of us who remember the Kennedy assassination, and information was not coming. We had no idea how serious the wound was. There was a report that from the hospital, somebody who had seen the president being rolled by said it looked bad, and you had that kind of thing going. And you had a building in this thing. Haig looking shaky, making a maladroit performance. Then there was the reference to open heart surgery. I think it was on ABC, Frank Reynolds, where they...
No, I believe it was NBC.
Was it NBC?
Made that statement.
Where they had mistaken open chest surgery for open heart surgery. And that deja vu was welling in me. I thought, you know, here we are again, that all of a sudden there seems to be these inklings of seriousness that fortunately, you know, faded in the next few hours. But it was building, I know, in my mind.
Let's go to calls. John, good evening. You're on the air. Are you there? I guess John is not. John, are you there? Go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
I was driving in my car and heard this and stopped at a payphone. I'm really intrigued by the talk show here, but I had one point that I really felt necessary, and that is that I think the extreme and complicated criticism of the media coverage of this event and such things seems kind of silly in light of the fact that President Reagan is alive and he is recovering very quickly. And just, you know, it might seem silly, but I think that we should be grateful that this attempt that was made on his life didn't come through, and that the media did have problems in communicating what indeed did happen. But I think that we as a nation should be grateful that we have a president that's alive and is going to be back on his feet again soon, and that the mistakes that were made were mistakes indeed, but they were honest mistakes, and there are plenty other of things that are going on in this country that aren't honest and aren't
I share the thought of everyone here at the table that we're all grateful that President Reagan is alive and apparently well or getting better as we speak. There is one other, and you bring up another point as to, you know, where was a mistake made. You mentioned that perhaps we're being overly critical of the media. Another mistake that was made by the FBI. Today, the Treasury Secretary, Donald Regan, testifying before congressional leaders on the role and the actions of the Secret Service, said that last October, when John W. Hinckley, the alleged assailant of the president, was picked up and arrested in Nashville, Tennessee, for carrying weapons at a time when President Carter was about to arrive in the city. That information about that arrest was known to the FBI, but was not passed on to the Secret Service. And
well,
I think that is where there is some incompetence.
That's known by the FBI that's not being passed on to the American public, and a lot more deceptively than the kind of things that were being critical of the media or the FBI or anyone for that matter. The point I'm trying to make is that there are a lot of deceptive things going on that are a lot more intentionally deceptive than this. And I think that if we spend as much energy being critical of mistakes or bonehead mistakes even, as we, you know, if we spend as much energy being critical of intentional deception that's going on in this country, things might be a lot better off.
Okay, I thank you very much for your comment. Let's bring up for discussion a possible another battle that may be brewing within the cabinet rank. We've got the one going on allegedly between Al Haig and the White House staff, and allegedly between Al Haig and Caspar Weinberger. When the Secretary of Treasury suggests that the FBI blew it by not providing the Secret Service information, the Attorney General, who is the overseer of the FBI, William Smith French, came on and he said, William French Smith, he said that it was improper, not improper, but perhaps the FBI, you know, that he's going to look into it. Now, do we have another battle brewing within the cabinet, you think, Dick?
I think it's a little too early to gauge that one as a potential conflict between especially Donald Regan and William French Smith. The former is, I think, there to add a moderating force and a big business attitude toward the economic policy of the country. The latter is there primarily to serve the president's wishes in terms of a law enforcement posture. They won't clash on basic policy. Now, since the Secret Service comes under Treasury, I think Regan is trying to protect his own, and I think Mr. Smith will wind up trying to justify whatever the FBI did. But in fact, if it is a stated policy that report should have gone to the Secret Service, they'll just have to live with the mistake. I don't think we know that at this point, but I don't see the kind of high-stakes power play between those two cabinet officials that might occur with others.
No, I agree with that. I think that so far in this administration, incidentally, I'm not one that says that everybody in the cabinet has to agree and sit around like little dummies and sort of nod the land of nod. I think that Franklin Roosevelt was the guy that had the most creative cabinet, and those guys disagreed between Ickes and Morgenthau and everything else. And I think the country was served by people who disagreed and even aired it sometimes. And I think that Regan's point was probably very well taken, and I give him credit for candor in telling in the in sort of a testimonial situation that he thought his agency was sort of short-sighted by the FBI. I think that serves the public well. And
sure.
I agree with Dick that I don't think it's a big battle.
Ed Rooney?
I don't think it's a big battle either, and I think that what we are experiencing now is this flurry of hindsight and Monday morning quarterbacking that we can remember from the Kennedy assassination, where the agents were under fire for failing to set forth certain information and so on, certain FBI agents that didn't tell about Oswald that should have had. And I think we're going to, the public is served by this. The agencies will do better as they did better after Kennedy.
The head of the Secret Service, who also testified today on the Hill, made an interesting comment. He suggested that perhaps if the FBI was not forced to operate under such strict guidelines by the Attorney General and could perhaps be a little looser in their domestic intelligence gathering, that perhaps they would have known more about John W. Hinckley. Now, I find it very curious that everyone is talking about how gun laws might be affected by the shooting of President Reagan, whereas at least the first trial balloon was dropped today, that perhaps we're going to see a loosening of domestic spying on the part of the FBI as a result of this.
I must say that I don't agree with that, but when President Kennedy was assassinated, J. Edgar was in charge, and nobody ever accused him of handling civil liberties with anything less than a heavy mailed fist. And
you're a Japanese American, you would.
That's right. And we were standing there with our face hanging out with Lee Harvey Oswald having a thing that the FBI evidently knew about but didn't follow through. So I don't think that subverting or changing some of the civil liberties thing is going to add us any more strength in that. Do you agree, gentlemen?
I'd just like to, I agree. I would just like to make this afterthought that there was an FBI agent named Hosty, H-O-S-T-Y, who was from Chicago, who was pilloried and criticized considerably for his actions regarding Oswald.
He was head of the Dallas Bureau at the time.
That's right, or worked in the
FBI.
Dallas Bureau. And now we have another homegrown Chicago, Tim McCarthy, who is a bona fide hero from this incident Monday, who was the Secret Service agent who Nancy Reagan says put his body in front of the president and saved the president's life. So historically, I guess these things even out. One incident, you have a goat from Chicago, and the next one, you have a hero.
But you have, the logical response would be stricter gun laws. And here, just less than a week after the assassination, or just a few days after the assassination, those of a conservative political bent seem to be using the assassination attempt on the president to turn around another very controversial issue, and that is trying to ease up, the domestic spying limitations that are on the FBI, using this as, this wouldn't have happened. I mean, they didn't say it that strongly, but that was certainly the implication today, that, if you would loosen these things up, the John W. Hinckleys of the world would not come out of the woodwork. Now, isn't that really perhaps abusing a situation and trying to use it for political gain?
They're going to come out of the woodwork. Hinckleys are going to come out of the woodwork no matter what, and I'm sure Dick would agree.
Well, I think the record just doesn't back up what Mr. Webster's trying to say about freer rein on the FBI, for the simple reason that in every single assassination attempt that we have had since John Kennedy, and we've had far too many to mull over here, every alleged assailant had a police record or had been picked up with guns or something else. Now, if in fact this man who's charged with this particular assault had some aberrations of behavior that would have led someone in whatever he was living, some police official, to say, this is the kind of guy that strikes me that could do something dangerous, and had forwarded his name to the FBI, and without any criminal record at all, the FBI was allowed to go and pry around. And in fact, had they been not able to do that, then they might be able to say, gosh, if we could do that, would it stop this? But for heaven's sakes, when you've got people running around airports with three handguns, when you've got people bringing in imported rifles and mail order rifles, when you've got other men with a whole cadre of weapons in their apartment, It strikes me as very difficult for a law enforcement agency to say we need greater freedom to check these people out.
As a matter of fact, I think that now, since a rightist leader has had an assassination attempt, Mr. Reagan, I think that the people who...
By an alleged rightist.
I think the conspiratorial people really are sort of in low gear. I recall after Mr. Kennedy, the two Kennedys were assassinated, and Martin Luther King, we had series of books about, was it the CIA and the FBI coming in? I don't find the only conspiratorial guy that I saw was a guy at midnight in a saloon who looked around after being overserved and said, somehow they're going to get all the Irish. Meeting Reagan, meeting McCarthy, and everything else.
Let me interrupt and identify. This is WBEZ Radio in Chicago. It's 8 o'clock in Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont. The name of the program is Inside Politics. Joining us this evening, Thomas Roser, Vice President of Government Affairs for a major Chicago-based corporation, President of the City Club of Chicago, and a regular of our Inside Politics panel. Dick Ciccone is here, political editor of the Chicago Tribune. Ed Rooney, assistant professor of journalism at Loyola University and a moderator of a media politics seminar at St. Xavier College. And Larry Horace, chairman of his own government relations consulting firm and consultant to the National Tax Limitation Committee, responsible for selling or setting up the grassroots support for the Reagan economic package here in the Middle West. They are our in-studio guests. 236-1531 is the telephone number. Let's go back to calls. Blanca, good evening. You're on the air.
Yes, I want to make a comment about this continuous criticism on Haig.
Okay.
Haig, I think, is an expertise, and anybody in these circumstances would be in that situation of being shaken. And I think the media is destroying him. I think it's too much gossiping about the situation instead of trying to solve the problem at a time he did the right thing. Internationally, the United States was in very critical situation. Poland was the age of revolution, and San Salvador was another problem, another possible civil war.
Well, so Blanca, let me ask you a question.
I don't think Haig did the wrong thing. I think he is a good man, and I think anybody in that situation would do it like he did. And I think there's nothing wrong with him.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's move on. Good evening, Jeff. You're on the air.
Yeah, well, given that there's a number of interpretations for what Haig said at the press conference, and in light of your interpretation, I'd like to know why CBS and Dan Rather felt it necessary to rerun the press conference, rerun the press conference and emphasize the interpretation that he had saved Speaks from a bad situation, that he had said, I'm in control here, which was true, you know, in that building, and more or less placate the Haig. And I throw out that, would it be perhaps that they were willing to sacrifice accuracy for the good relations of the State Department and the administration later on.
I cannot recall the specific replay of that press conference that you referred to. Do you recall what time that happened? Because I never saw the complete press conference replayed.
5 o'clock. It was later in the afternoon. It was more or less after they.
And they replayed the entire press conference.
They replayed sections of it, and then Dan Rather gave interpretations. He would show Speaks for a couple seconds. Say Speaks was becoming confused, and then he would say Secretary Haig came in.
I did not see that that replay that you're referring to. The only thing that I am going by is the time frame, the timetable as to who said what at what particular time, and the specific point that I made was that it was Alexander Haig that first announced that or confirmed that the president was in surgery, and that he brought up the possible severity of the wound when he talked about that it was in the lung. No one had even mentioned the word lung prior to 3:16, 3 minutes or three at 3:16 and 15 seconds of last Monday. Dick Ciccone.
Well, I think shortly after the replay of that press conference, CBS also went to Fred Graham, their Washington-based Supreme Court correspondent. And he and Rather went into a lengthy explanation on just how badly Haig had misconstrued his power, repeating the statute and the congressional amendment, pointing it out. So I didn't see the review of the news conference that you're alluding to. Mm-hmm. But in fact, if rather was trying to make excuses for Haig. It was very shortly thereafter, it was around 6 o'clock, that they went into this long explanation with Fred Graham explaining how legally Haig had failed to make his position clear.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And Graham was a lawyer, yeah, of course.
Okay, yeah, they were... He also was having difficulty going through the line of succession at the time, and Dan Rather read it to him, which I thought was rather curious. Thanks very much. We have to move on.
Thank you.
Larry, do you have a comment? Okay, Bob, good evening. You're next.
Oh, hi. Listen, in a kind of a jocular vein, I'm going to kind of kid you men and all the gentlemen there and sort of wish that you could listen to your program after it's over.
Okay.
Because
some of us do.
Well, I'm just going to ask a question. Why are all of you fellows sounding like closet liberals? You really? I'm surprised at you. You all sound like you're, you know, the Eastern liberals and they're running dogs.
That comment's very interesting because I come from a conservative constituency, and frequently I'm introduced here as the Reagan guy, and the other day, the longtime Reagan supporter, which, in fact, I am a Reagan guy.
Uh-huh.
But after I appeared on a similar show and criticized Haig, all my conservative friends... really lined up and gave me a round. And what I'm seeing is the conservative constituency of which I have been a part standing up for Al Haig, and I find that Al Haig has a strong conservative following, and it wasn't so long ago, as the late Mayor Daley said, sir, when we were trying to get Al Haig confirmed, the people were saying, uh-oh, he's a tool of Henry the K. We've got to watch that guy. Human Events Now and all the other rightist organizations are saying Al Haig right on. So I think you're reflecting good-naturedly, I would say, a lot of people who are conservative in nature saying, let's go easy on this guy because he's a strong, hawkish foreign policy which serves to supplant the sort of, as one person said, but spaghetti spine and put some iron in. Isn't that how you feel?
All right, but now let me ask you, Jeff, what specifically did you find that was said by anyone on this panel of a political left-right nature that you found objectionable? We're not talking about Al Haig's politics. We're talking about his conduct at a time of national crisis.
Are you speaking to me?
Yes.
Oh, my name is Bob.
I'm sorry.
Well, no, I was doing my paperwork here, and I kept listening to the knives coming out, and it seemed like all you gentlemen were sharpening them, because one after another was couldn't wait to get in and chop them up a little bit. Truthfully.
No, but you mentioned that you put a liberal tag to that.
Well,
why does that...
he does, I think, I would say this, and he can answer for himself, but I think...
In other words, anybody that attacks a conservative who makes a mistake, whether it have anything to do with political philosophy, is considered liberal.
No, I've seen the liberals make mistakes and not get attacked.
If you're a regular listener to the program, you know that when liberals make mistakes, as they have done numerous times in the last 20 years, in discussing that, we point that out.
But let me
ask you a question, and we'll let you interpret your own words or make your own comment. It's the question that I posed about 20 minutes ago. Do you think it was in the best interest for Alexander Haig to announce to the world that the president was in surgery and had been shot in the left lung when 1 minute prior to that the official White House spokesman refused to confirm that the president was in surgery? Was that in the best interest of calming a nation?
I think so. I think it did calm. I mean, the people
calmed a nation by telling somebody that things were more serious than had been reported a minute before by the White House?
Prior to that comment, there was such confusion going on. And, of course, everybody's listening to the radio and the TV. I think when the man comes out and says, well, he's in there, he's getting operated on, I think it's more of a... Okay, everybody said, okay, he's in the hospital and he's getting operated.
Okay, well, we have a difference of
opinion. I'd like to throw one more comment about Haig at the risk of sounding like a closet liberal, I think. It's been said several times tonight, I think, by several people or some of the people sitting around this table, that he was shaken, he was emotional, and that's understandable, and which one of us wouldn't be? Well, I don't know whether I would be or not. But no one's asked me to be the Secretary of State lately. And if we have a four-star general, and we go back a little bit to the Kennedy era and that best and brightest phrase, a man that was chief of the White House staff during one of the most traumatizing times in American history, the first resignation of a president, a man that was chief of staff of NATO, if this man is going to get shaken and panic in a moment of crisis, then we don't have any best and brightest, and we never will.
Yeah. That's true.
Okay.
Thank you.
I must add to that that I was uncomfortable with Haig's performance, and I did a little change of thought on Haig, because I saw, and you know, maybe in that minute and a half or whatever it was, there was something about him that said, you know, he's too quick to seize power, he's too quick to step in there, he's too quick, and you know, you have to have a certain respect for the Republic. And he did go through a crisis with Nixon where he must have known the succession. I mean, they had to sit there and talk about succession when they're talking about the resignation of the president. And those subtleties that came out discomforted me. And someone earlier said that he wants to be the president, and I thought to myself, that's his modest ambition.
I'd say, though, coming from Maine Township, where some people fly the flag upside down because the Republic's in danger, as I was waiting to get my train the next day, you bet, the way I was waiting to get my train the next day, some guys came over to me and said, Roosevelt, it wasn't 7:40 in the morning, and I give you a pop right in the jaw for what you said about Al Haig, he's a great American. So I want to tell you that maybe what we are seeing here is a cult, sort of a cult figure coming from the right, and I wouldn't put that down, because the right does want to have somebody who is, they perceive a person.
They like
who
an underdog. They like an underdog, and in the perception of many,
they're closet liberals, because we are criticizing a man not because he, his voice was trembling, but because they see in General Haig a strong foreign policy that they hope will endure. And I think maybe that's what this
may be a strong foreign policy, but is the man going to be able to act when the going gets tough?
I'm just saying, between Bush and Haig, it looks like right now, tonight, Haig might have the right on a side.
All right, well, I'm sure he does. Yep. But in baseball vernacular, Al Haig choked. We're going to move on. Good evening, Bill. You're next.
Yes. No one at the beginning of the program reflected any awareness of a couple of things that I heard the next day. A couple of people on elevators said, sorry, they missed. And I just wonder if you're not too euphoric in saying that we're going to have Reagan for 8 years because someone shot at him when he is destroying a lot of the programs of the last 20 or 30 year period. Did any of you sense that? I noticed in the newspapers there was a
it's a school in Oklahoma where they cheered young.
A few students in the student body laughed. Did any of you hear any people talking in that vein personally right after it happened or the next day?
No, I didn't.
The only experience that I can relate is someone who said they weren't moved by it.
I heard a couple of people say
they are vehement anti-Reagan people. They didn't want him to die. They were repelled by the violence, but there was absolutely no emotional reaction at all. That's the only thing I've heard. Dick Ciccone?
Yeah. At the Tribune, we got some feedback from reporters and photographers who were out on the street at the time, rather surprisingly, who got some pretty raw phrases tossed at them, like, you know, who cares? But let me say this. I can remember precisely the same thing happening in 1963. A fellow came up to me shortly afterwards, and I said something to the effect of, my God, can you imagine that happening? And the guy said, he never did anything for me. Why should I worry about him? And at the same time, you'll recall, there were the same stories about schoolrooms
in Dallas.
In Dallas, as a matter of fact, where people cheered. So I suppose my gut feeling is, in some respects, some people are a bit so shocked by it all, they want to sound very blasé and crass.
Right.
And I suppose there's always a few screwballs around that'll say things like that about anything.
Defense mechanism.
Okay, thank you very much. 236-1531. Tom, you mentioned about 15 minutes ago about the conspiratorialists in the nation that see a conspiracy in everything. Was anyone surprised, and again, when I ask this question, I'm not suggesting that there's any conspiracy here, but was it not curious that of the relationship between the Hinckley family and the Bush family, being a major contributor to his campaign, and the relationships of their sons?
Well, I think with admirable restraint, the country has survived that. I understand that, and I have read that. And no one that I have met thinks or has even mentioned, even in a jocular sense or even a conspiratorial sense, that was anything more than just one of those weird coincidences that happen in our nation occasionally. You're on the same elevator with somebody whom later And I'm not knocking conspiracy theories, incidentally, I'm just saying that I think that Haig is going to come out as a folk hero of the right.
I think it's the seed from which the conspiratorial theories are going to begin to grow, and I wouldn't be surprised to see the National Enquirer, you know, headline that portion of it, and you'll always have people who will look for that nuance. I think it was proper reserve on the media's part, and I think fortuitous for the nation that the alleged assailant, as we say at this point, was an individual with psychiatric problems and into some, you know, the fringe elements.
I want to bring up something that Ed mentioned very early in the program, and that is the way in which perhaps the press will be treated and access to the president will be perhaps lessened because of this. Do you want to elaborate a little bit on that, Ed?
I would sense that the reporters like Dick and other reporters around the country are going to have for the rest of the year problems in interviewing Reagan, interviewing Bush, getting at them, that there will be much tighter security on their movements in and out of buildings, in and out of airports, in and out of the White House. And
generally speaking, is there a, you know, one of the controversies that still rages is, was he in a defined press area?
No,
or was
no,
it an open
it was
public area?
No, it was announced by the head of the Secret Service in Washington this afternoon that he was in a public area. There was no defined press area. He was behind a rope, a restraining rope, and he was in a public area, which he could have been in, which he should have.
Dave, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I was following the reports of the assassination attempt through the afternoon on ABC, and right about or immediately following the tantrum that Frank Reynolds threw when he found
which
out...
Which one?
The one when he found out that Brady, in fact, wasn't dead, and he started yelling at everyone to get it right. They made a quick cut to a press conference that was being held by a guy by the name of, I believe, Sampson or Simpson, who is a radio reporter for the Mutual Network. And he was holding a kind of a full-fledged press conference explaining that he had a friend of a doctor up in radiology who had just examined Brady's CAT scan and various other x-rays, and he was telling them that there's no way he's going to live and no one ever survives a gunshot wound like this. And I was kind of amused by the fact that all of a sudden here is a radio reporter now becoming kind of taking over as a press corps function and disseminating this type of information, which wound up being bad but getting incredible credibility from the press. He was saying, people would say, who did you hear it from? Well, it was a secondhand friend of this doctor that I knew. And
well, at a time like that, I would assume that reporters become other reporters' best sources.
Right, and also ABC probably wanted to get away from Reynolds as fast as they could for a while and go to somebody else or something else.
I think if there was anything memorable about the coverage, it was the frequency with which you saw the on-camera anchorman reporter suddenly get the blank look that told you that something was coming over the earphones. The voice started to, and then they put their hand up to their ear and then come out with the other report. And it was sort of getting humorous after a while as these people were tapping their earphones to see what was going on.
But I was concerned that if Larry speaks or someone said that this is secondhand source information, that the press wouldn't tolerate that and find it unacceptable. I was finding the Simpson guy. He was explaining what was going on with Reagan and that with a collapsed lung, that it was like a plane with two engines and they have to feather the right engine. Yeah. And it was almost kind of. It was comical.
Well, I also think that if you look at the White House press staff, the press that were at the White House is the way I should phrase it. They were very belligerent during those times. Of course, they were panicky themselves. They wanted information, and they were receiving more information from the outside than they were receiving from Larry Speaks at the White House. So they became a little belligerent and wanted to get straight information, and they were, for the most part, not given the answers that they wanted. We do have to move on, Dave. I thank you very much.
Okay.
A word about upcoming programs on Inside Politics. Next week, on April 9th, we're going to be talking about whatever happened to the Republican Party in the city of Chicago. Our guest will be J. Robert Barr, who's the Cook County Republican chairman, Robert Athey, who is a campaign and political advisor to W. Clement Stone, one of the chief benefactors of the Republican Party here in the Chicagoland area. And our third guest is Don Neltner, who is Republican ward committeeman of the 43rd Ward, who wants to shape up the Republican Party in Cook County. So they will be our guests next week. And next week happens to be the 50th anniversary of the last day in office of Big Bill Thompson, the last Republican to sit in City Hall. So it'll be kind of a 50th anniversary flashback look at what's happened to the Republican Party over the last 50 years and how come they are where they are, which is basically nowhere. Also, for those of you who have been waiting the official announcement as to the arrival of Mayor Jane Byrne on this program, it is now official. She will be here on April 30th. That's 3 weeks from tonight, so mark that on your calendars, April 30th. In fact, I guess it's 4 weeks from tonight. So mark that down. She's going to tell us all about life in Cabrini Green and whatever else happens to her between now and then. Good evening. You're on the air, Andrew.
Yes, as a voter who neither voted for the present administration, nor would he if he had to vote for him again tomorrow, I think you've got a panel there that's just cutting General Haig to pieces. I don't think that he was inaccurate when he said that he was in control. He was constitutionally in control. He was, in fact, the senior cabinet member present. I don't know. The vice president was on the way, but the cabinet was in the White House.
What was he in control of?
He was in control of the White House, if nothing else. At least somebody had guts enough to stand up and say something. The president's been shot. He's been shot in the lung. And we're here. We're handling things.
I think what we've been trying to do here tonight is reflect reality. And to be honest,
yeah,
he has some considerable problems as far as his future is concerned.
Well,
off of not only last Monday, but his prior relationships with Meese and others in the White House. And
there again.
And he is on shaky ground, to use terrible cliche.
Let me interrupt.
Sure.
As a plain old voter. How soon we seem to forget the Nixon regime with all those White House functionaries. Well, you know, those unsophisticated voters like myself hope that the president and his cabinet are running the country, not all these staff members. Now, I don't know anything about Baker, Nice, or all these others. And I'm sorry to hear that they're running it instead of the secretaries of state, et cetera, et cetera.
But the Mr. Baker and Mr. Meese are working directly under the president.
Yeah,
so they are perhaps they are closer to what is really going on in the average day operation than perhaps any secretary member is, whether it be Secretary of State or Secretary of Interior.
Well, I don't want to get into a philosophical discussion, but frankly, I didn't vote for either Jim Baker, Ed Meese, or Alexander Haig. I don't understand why anyone should feel that any particular cabinet member should have more authority than the White House Chief of Staff, and it doesn't necessarily follow that they should or should not. It usually is up to the President to designate whomever in the cabinet or the White House he chooses to make the most powerful aide. We have seen, certainly in recent administrations, where Henry Kissinger, both as National Security Chief and Secretary of State at a latter date, became very powerful. We saw in other administrations the Haldeman and Ehrlichmans that became powerful. I think in the last administration you'd find that the press secretary, Jody Powell, was probably far more important than any single cabinet member, particularly since President Carter threw most of them out. So I don't think it's a question of because he is the Secretary of State, he automatically should rank higher than the Chief of Staff or the Secretary of Defense.
No. I said no. I meant constitutionally he was the senior cabinet member, and he spoke up. That's all.
Okay.
Okay,
we thank you very much. The support for Al Haig is growing as we speak. 236-1531. Good evening. You're on the air, Andrew. Are you there? John, are you there?
John, yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I would. One thing that I've noticed in the last few days in the upsurge in the movement for gun control is that two issues really get confused. in these recent attacks on media figures that we've had, and that is the issue of attacks on media figures and the issue of gun control. I don't think that the real problem that we have with gun violence in this country is the same problem that we have with crazy individuals going after media personalities. And I think the way to try and curb gun violence is not by trying to control the hardware, the guns, because there's too many out there, and they last forever. And by definition, criminals won't obey the gun laws.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, we should come down hard on criminal gunmen. Anyone that is involved in any violation of the law using a handgun or even with a handgun on him. If we had a law like that, Hinckley would have not had an opportunity after Tennessee incidents with the guns in the airport.
Okay, I thank you very much. Let's move on and sneak one more call in. Carolyn, good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening. I've been listening to your whole program, and it's something that has to be clarified right away.
Right.
And I should have called earlier, but I was very, very upset. The situation with Dan Rather is not as it has been presented. I watched the program. Rather stopped his program. He turned to the people that were off camera. I've never seen this in a television news program before, ever. He stopped his program. He said, hey, I can't go with this. How do we know this? Who's your sources? I mean, he took, you know, many, many seconds of precious airtime to say, you know, we can't go with this, before he said what it was.
But
he checked out his sources first, he said, we think.
But correct me if I'm wrong, and again, I'm not criticizing any of the anchor people, because, again, I don't know how anybody would have responded in the same circumstance. However, I believe that he went to that, you know, that position after they were aware that they had made a mistake on Brady. That did not happen prior to the Brady announcement.
I believe it happened prior to the Brady announcement as far as death was concerned. I was very concerned. I was getting very antsy. Why aren't they saying anything about Brady? And it had occurred to me something was really, really seriously wrong with the man, and conceivably he had died half an hour earlier, but they hadn't reached his wife or something like that. But I'm fairly positive that he said that before he...
Well, actually, the Brady announcement came from Jed Duvall.
Mm-hmm.
I think Rather introduced him by saying there's some good news or an upsetting news, something to that effect, and Duvall then said something about the president, and we have some sad news. It appears that Jim Brady has not survived surgery. I could be mistaken as well, because I think we're all flitting back and forth to a variety of sources on this besides TV.
Mm-hmm.
But my recollection is that Duvall first announced it.
Absolutely.
He did. But what I'm saying is, you know, in other words, Rather was handed a piece of paper and he was supposed to say something and then go to this guy. And then he just stopped.
My recollection is that happened later, but you know, again, as Dick said, we've got a different point of reference.
No, I do remember that, and I thought it was commendable. I was in apprehension for a while that you know, we were going to hear something dire, but it turned out to be a minor report that he did have confirmed, and I guess, you know, that was a commendable act, but we tend to dwell in these kind of discussions on those points where the systems didn't work as they ought to have.
I got time for one last remark?
Sure do.
Now, this, again, is beating the dead issue.
Okay, you've got about 15 seconds.
Mr. Haig. Okay, I come from a military family, and Haig is not your ordinary military man. He's not been tested under fire. I think the gentleman's name is Rose or something?
Tom Roser.
Yeah, that spoke earlier and made some excellent points. I was, you know, feeling very pleased that he brought up these points. This is also a man that was obviously not coordinating with others. He was not in charge of his own, quote, White House that he was in charge of. He was not acting like a statesman. I think this is possibly reflected in the fact that Weinberg, who's a civilian, you know, who was in charge of ATW under a previous administration, he's the man that's been next designated as far as military crisis command is concerned.
Okay, on that note, we're out of time, okay? I'm sorry that we wouldn't have additional or don't have additional time this evening, but our thanks to Dick Buckley for allowing us to go an extra half hour because of the gravity of the news last week. We did have an opportunity to spend an extra half hour with you. Our thanks this evening to Dick Ciccone, political editor of the Chicago Tribune, for joining us. Ed Rooney, assistant professor of journalism at Loyola University. Larry Horst, chairman of his own government relations consulting firm. And Thomas Roser, vice president of government relations for a major Chicago-based corporation and president of the City Club of Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thank you very much for joining us on this special expanded edition of Inside Politics this Thursday night. We will be back next Thursday night at 7 o'clock talking about whatever happened to the Republican Party in the city of Chicago. Until then, good night, everyone.
For the finest in commercial-free news coverage, stay with WBEZ all day tomorrow. We begin at 5 a.m. for you early risers with Morning Edition. Local and national news, including weather and traffic information, that gets you through the morning rush hour smoothly through 8 a.m. And at 5 p.m., it's the Peabody Award-winning news magazine, All Things Considered, the finest in-depth news program available. And at 6:30, it's All Things Chicago, a look at the events of the day affecting Chicagoland. That's Morning Edition 5 through 8 a.m., All Things Considered at 5 p.m., followed by All Things Chicago. Tomorrow and every weekday on WBEZ. And if you'd like to receive your own detailed listening...